So once again, it's Earth Day, and I'm taking a little stock of my life and my lifestyle. Is that what you're doing today, Lynn Scher?
No need, John. I've done that long ago.
Wow.
I've given up lots of things to help contribute to improving life on the planet.
Really? You got a long list there?
It's getting longer. Let's see. I've given up plastic bags.
Nice.
I drive a Prius.
Impressive.
I print on both sides of the paper.
Didn't think of that.
Cool, huh? I turn the water off when I brush my teeth twice a day.
Thanks for sharing.
I have stopped eating Chilean sea bass.
Whoa.
And thank goodness my apartment building recycles. Huh. Et tu, John?
Well, I have two cars still. Neither are hybrids.
Gas guzzler.
My wife and I have four kids.
And they, of course, recycle.
Well, not really. We're mostly organic.
Mostly? Mostly doesn't cut it, John.
I guess not.
So, Hockenberry, what have you got to help out planet Earth on Earth Day?
I'm a public radio host. Does that help?
Oh, John. Well, it's a start. There's your takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Well, what do they say? The journey begins with a single step. Good morning. It's Wednesday, April 22nd, Earth Day. I'm John Hockenberry. Lynn Scher is here for Adora Udoji. Good morning, Lynn.
Good morning, John. Ahead this hour, polls are open in South Africa. We'll take a closer look at the election there. And then we'll test your eco-intelligence with the hidden impact of going green and how to win a cosmic war in the Middle East. Those stories coming up, but first, these headlines.
CIA officials adopted harsh interrogation tactics without any real legislative oversight or investigation into the origins of the techniques. That's according to an analysis released by our partner, The New York Times. Memos show the practice was approved in a series of high-level meetings in 2002. Yesterday, President Obama says it's up to the Justice Department to decide whether to prosecute Bush administration officials who authorized the policy. Polls are open in South Africa on a rainy election day. This is the fourth election since the apartheid regime ended 15 years ago. Here's former President Thabo Mbeki.
It's a secret ballot, really. It's very important that everybody must understand that, because I think the future of our country in part depends on people voting according to their consciences.
He's a member of the ANC. The African National Congress is expected to win most of the 23 million expected votes. We'll have more on that in just a few minutes. Lynn?
A Somali pirate appeared before a federal court in New York yesterday. The judge ruled that he would be tried as an adult. Prosecutors claimed that he is 18, but his defense lawyers say he is just 15. A crewman from the cargo ship attacked last week said the suspect was the first to board the vessel while firing an AK-47. Former Cuban leader Fidel Castro says President Obama misinterpreted his brother Raul when he said that Cuba wants to be totally open in diplomatic talks with the U.S. Fidel Castro says the president had no right to suggest that Cuba make even that small concession. Castro responded with an essay on a government website.
Chrysler has a plan. The banks and hedge funds that hold most of Chrysler's debt say they propose forgiving $2.5 billion in debt in return for a 40% stake in the company. The Dow was up 2% yesterday. The S&P begins trading at 850. So it's Earth Day today. Question for you, what's the one poison you still won't give up? And go to your cupboard. Open it up. Say, fill in the blanks. I was so surprised to find blank in blank. 8778-MY-TAKE.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at KnightFoundation.org.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
And I'm Lynn Scher in for Adora Udoji. It may be Earth Day today, but it's always election day somewhere. Today it's in South Africa, where the general election is seen as the most important since the end of apartheid 15 years ago.
A lot of people are willing to be involved in the change in South Africa now, and a lot of publicity has come through America with Obama and those elections. I think a lot more people are voting, and the turnout is going to be great.
That was an unidentified voter in South Africa today. The winner is not in doubt. The African National Congress, led by Jacob Zuma, is expected to win by a landslide. Both Zuma and Nelson Mandela have already cast their votes, and Mr. Mandela, of course, supporting Mr. Zuma. But what will today's election mean for this big and powerful nation? What might it mean for us here in the United States? Earlier today, we got the inside scoop on Mr. Zuma from Andrew Meldrum. He is the Africa editor of the web-based Global Post in Washington. And Andrew Meldrum spent 27 years in South Africa. He knows Mr. Zuma very, very well. But before we went to him, we skipped across the ocean to speak with the BBC's Africa editor, Martin Plaut. We talked with Martin earlier this morning from outside a polling station in a suburb of Cape Town. And when we spoke, I asked Martin to give us the numbers.
This is one of 19,000 polling stations across this country. It's a large country, although perhaps not large by American standards. 23 million registered voters, 12 million women, and 10 million men. So there's a lot of voting to get done.
And what about, Martin, the young people? We're told that this is a historic election, not only because of the importance, we'll get to the issues in just a minute, but I gather a huge possibility for young people to be voting.
Oh, I think that is absolutely right. You know, the young people are coming out in droves. It was actually very interesting. We spent yesterday in a township called Khayelitsha. It's a very poor area on the edge of Cape Town. And there we met two young people in their 20s who are unemployed. One of them is going to go to the polls. The other one says, you know, what's the point? To be honest, most people are coming out to vote. They're expecting a turnout of 80%. So
wow.
That's pretty good by any standards.
80%? We don't get anything near that in
Martin,
this country.
I heard something yesterday. I wonder if you could confirm it for me. Are young voters called born frees in South Africa during this election campaign?
That's absolutely right. In other words, the people who did not live under apartheid, the people who were born since apartheid or grew up since apartheid, they're a totally different group of people. And they, you know, they make up their own minds. They're into all sorts of other things. I mean, you know, their parents' generation fought for the right to vote. And if you ask why there's an 80% turnout, you should see how hard people had to struggle for that vote. And if you see what I mean, in a sense, it's the younger people then are saying, well, yes, our parents are, you know, they told us to vote, they taught us where we were going, but, you know, we're not sure that we're going to do it. Maybe this time we'll vote the ANC, maybe next time we won't.
You mentioned unemployment. Unemployment is huge there. Crime is a problem. What are the big issues for the voters today?
Well, I think those are two of them. I mean, just to give you an idea of unemployment, it is absolutely staggering. It is the highest in the industrialized world. Officially, 23% of the population are unemployed. Unofficially, if you add in people who've just given up and stopped looking for work, it could be as high as 35 or even 40%. Now, you know, there is no social security network for these people. They have to live on either their savings, meager as they are, or even on the tiny sums that are paid for pensions. A lot of people just live on, you know, the pensions of their grandparents if they can't find work. It's a tough existence for people out there. So a lot of people have been saying, you know, the thing I want from this election is a job. But that is going to be very hard in a recession, obviously. The other issue is, of course, crime. You know, there are 18,000 murders a year in South Africa. I mean, that is just an extraordinary number. To give you a comparison, in Britain, which has more or less the same number of people, we have 600 murders a year. So this is just, you know, this side of a small-scale civil war. One woman is raped every 30 seconds.
Martin, stand by if you would, because we want to go now to Andrew Meldrum in Boston to talk about the man whose job it will be to lead South Africa out of those problems. Andrew Meldrum, you have covered Jacob Zuma, this man who was a goat herder in the rural Zulu heartland, said to be as comfortable in leopard skins as in a pinstripe suit. Is he a suit? Is he, in fact, the leader for these times?
Well, he is going to be the leader for the times. That's virtually certain. And he's made an incredible political comeback. 2 years ago, he was down and out facing corruption charges. He was on trial for rape, and he was acquitted of rape, and the corruption charges were dropped. And he has been a very deft politician, appealing both to the populist, to the masses of South Africa, and also then making diplomatic statements and being very, very smooth. He's a charming guy, and he is going to lead South Africa.
Give us a sense from this point of view. We are used to this very smooth, very exciting leadership, charismatic leadership of Nelson Mandela, who has endorsed Jacob Zuma. We are also used to Bishop Tutu, who is very angry about Jacob Zuma. What are we in this country meant to make of him?
Well, it's hard. The jury is out on Jacob Zuma. And for instance, Archbishop Tutu has said that Jacob Zuma is not the man to lead South Africa. He was Bishop Tutu was very upset at the crowds that were outside of Jacob Zuma's rape trial. Thousands of people demonstrating day after day, very angry statements against women. They burned panties and said, "Burn the bitch, burn the bitch." So it was really an ugly scene. And Tutu said, you know, no leader of our nation can have crowds supporting him like that. And
he's also, as long as you mention women, he's also a polygamist. I know it's legal in the Zulu tribe, but he's got a couple of wives. How's that going to play here?
Well, it's really not a question of how it plays in the United States. It's a question of how it plays in South Africa. And, you know, to the majority of South Africans, of his followers, you know, that is fine. What's more difficult is, for instance, and he has spoken to women's groups after his rape trial and said, "I'm sorry if anything was offensive. I believe that women have an equal place in the political system of South Africa." Likewise, on gays, he had recently made a statement saying, "Oh, if any gay comes to me, I'm going to beat him up," to a rural crowd. And then a week later in Johannesburg, he said, "Well, you know, gays actually played an important role in South Africa's fight against apartheid, and in fact, they have an important place in South African society." So he shows a flexibility of being able to play it both ways.
Let's go back to Martin Platt standing by in South Africa. Martin Platt, tell me what the folks there think about this man. Is he, in fact, the guy they want, or does he happen to be the guy of the moment?
Well, I think both are true, but I think there's a side to Jacob Zuma that we don't very often see, and that is that he is also an extremely adept negotiator and reconciler. He brought together the ANC and Inkatha, which is a Zulu-based party. He's a Zulu himself. He ended what was effectively a civil war in that province in 94. And, you know, he brought reconciliation there and he brought people together, which is why people are enormously respectful of him. The other thing he did was he played a very, very vigorous role internationally in bringing about the end of the Burundi civil war. Again, his negotiation skills are absolutely first class. He's a very clever man who has no education whatsoever, but this doesn't tell us what he's going to be like when he becomes president. I think, you know, that's just something you cannot tell until somebody actually has the reins of power.
And just from both of you, starting with you, Martin, what about the relationship between Jacob Zuma and President Obama? What do you predict there?
I guess that they will get on. As Andrew was saying, you know, this is a very smooth guy, very charming, and I guess that they will get on pretty well. You know, Jacob Zuma is someone who has seen the international stage. He has spent many years abroad, including being trained in the Soviet Union. I mean, this guy was a fighter, huh? He was a liberation struggle fighter.
And a man that was
the international scene.
And a man that was in prison. He was on Robben Island as well.
Hmm. For 10 years and had a really hard time of it there.
Andrew Meldrum, tell me about the potential relationship with President Obama. Have the two men met, by the way?
As far as I know, they have not yet met.
What will happen when they do?
Well, I think that you'll see quite a good scene from the two of them. Jacob Zuma likes to sing. He likes to dance. He dances and sings for his campaign. And he is, you know, an authentic African leader, and he will make the most of it. He will make music, and I think Obama will receive.
New music about to come out of South Africa after today's elections. That is Andrew Meldrum, Africa editor of the web-based Global Post in Boston. We also spoke to BBC Africa editor Martin Plaut, who was outside of a polling station in Cape Town, South Africa. We'll be right back.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, asking what is responsibility in this day and age? Everybody has their own opinion. Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning for Earth Day. Some work for you. What's the one poison you still won't give up? And go to your cupboard, take out an item, fill in the blanks here. I was surprised to find blank in my blank.
This is Scott from New Bedford, Mass. I was shocked to find out that table salt contains sugar. It actually has dextrose written on the packaging. Go figure.
This is Mitch from Brooklyn. I was shocked to discover that there was cheese in my Velveeta.
Call with your poisons and the ones you didn't know about. 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. Lynn?
So, how many pieces of plastic do you have in your pocket? You know, credit cards. And are they part of the economic crisis? Well, that's what the House Financial Services Committee starts work on today. It's a bill that would rein in some of the industry practices that are truly awful, from higher interest rates on past balances to fees for paying by phone or online. Tomorrow, President Obama is meeting with the heads of the credit card divisions of 14 major banks. Anya Kamenetz, a staff writer at Fast Company magazine and the author of Generation Debt, joins us with a look at what new regulation we can expect for credit card companies and what that is going to mean for the rest of us. Anya, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me, Lynn.
So first of all, just quickly, tick off a couple of the things that credit card companies are doing that are really, really ugly.
Ooh, okay, so universal default. So that means if you're late on any bill, they can raise your credit card interest rate. Retroactive rate increases. So you ran up a balance when you had a zero introductory interest rate, and all of a sudden the interest on that balance is 25%.
Out of nowhere, right?
Out of nowhere. Anytime for any reason, that's in the fine print there. They can raise your rates anytime for any reason, basically whether it's a factor affecting the whole industry or a factor that's just affecting that company, they can raise your interest rates. So, I mean, really, when you have that one, it's like it's not really a contract.
You mentioned fine print. Is it worth it to read the fine print? God, there's a lot of it when those bills come.
You know, it is worth it to read the fine print. These practices are widespread, but they're not absolutely universal. There are certain companies that are known for issuing what's called fee harvester cards.
What's a fee harvester
that
card?
That sounds ugly.
It does, doesn't it?
John was cringing.
It is kind of an ugly name. Cards that have a very low initial credit limit, maybe $250, and 200 of that might come in fees. It's actually effectively only a $50 card.
It's just shocking, I must say. But may I mention, would any of these things pertain if you actually paid your bill off?
Well, that is a really interesting question, and I will refer to my parents who were affected by Hurricane Katrina. The credit card bills came to their house, and they were understandably a little late paying them off because they weren't in the house, and all three of their credit card interest rates went up to 25%. So I think that just about anybody can have a mishap or a misunderstanding, even if they do pay off their bill, and these fees are designed to catch just about everybody.
Anya, if I may, I want to play a quote from Larry Summers, the director of the National Economic Council. This is from Meet the Press, talking about President Obama.
We need to do things to stop the marketing of credit in ways that addicts people to it, and so that our households are again savings and families are again preparing to send their kids to college for their retirement and so forth.
Well, he was obviously talking more about credit cards, not necessarily about President Obama, but he used a phrase, credit that addicts people. Are we suffering from credit card addiction?
Well, this is a really interesting question. I think it pertains not only to credit cards, but also to forms of payday lending and check cashing and that kind of thing, that these are really designed to get you into a trap. So it's not about credit for convenience, despite what the ads say. You know, this is really about getting you in over your head, making sure that you are paying off more and more every month. And the easy availability of credit from the time that people are, you know, starting their freshman year of college, I think it does start a pattern going on.
It sounds like agriculture. I was thinking of it to the fee harvester card. It is agriculture.
You can
harvest
see
the money.
The big machine,
yeah,
the big
exactly.
McCormick Reaper
the
out there. Yeah. Now, what about, you talk about starts in college, Anya. So young people and credit, are they the ones that are getting hit with these really big interest rates the most? What's going to happen with them?
Well, I mean, obviously young people with generation debt, that's been my major concern. I think that the real problem with young people is that they get inculcated into this culture of debt, right? Because they have to take out student loans. That's the major way that people pay for college. And given that you're already borrowing $20,000 to go to school, it seems normal to sign up for a campus credit card. These credit cards are branded with the university name. It seems totally official, totally normal.
These hearings that are being held today, what really is the point? I mean, the Federal Reserve has already drafted new rules to curb these practices. They go into effect 2010, is that right? So what do we need new legislation for?
Well, Christopher Dodd, Senator Dodd, has been on this case for a long time, and if his version of the bill gets passed, it's going to be a little bit stronger, a little bit stricter. But, you know, personally, I'm in favor of raking these guys over the coals a little bit. It's not just a regulatory issue. This is really a moral issue, and the fact that we've had this unchecked spread and growth of consumer credit, it's part of the credit bubble. It's part of the crisis that we're in. It's a very important issue.
And how about you, Anya? How's your credit card bill looking?
It's okay this month. I did have to go in and change the payment due date because they did change my due date by a week so that I would, you know, they tried to move it up on me. So I had to change the automatic payment, but I do pay it off every month.
Anya Kamenetz, a staff writer at Fast Company magazine and the author of Generation Debt. Thanks so much. And now, Femi Okay with even more headlines.
Thank you very much, Lynn. The time is coming up to 28 minutes past the hour. David Kellerman, the acting CFO of mortgage giant Freddie Mac, was found dead at his home this morning. Police have not confirmed if the death was from suicide. The 41-year-old Kellerman has been Freddie Mac's chief financial officer since September and was with the company for more than 16 years. The Senate has confirmed President Obama's choice to be the next U.S. ambassador to Iraq. Chris Hill will take the position over the strenuous objections of Republican Senator Sam Brownback, who filibustered the appointment.
Consider the qualifications of Ambassador Hill, the problems that have come under his watch in the Korean talks, and not confirm him as to be our ambassador for Iraq in a situation where he's produced such terrible results.
The senator accused Hill of ignoring human rights abuses while he was the Bush administration's chief negotiator with North Korea. But Senate Foreign Relations Chair John Kerry says that Hill acted on instructions from the White House and that he's the right man for the job.
Ambassador Hill is a proven expert negotiator. He's a problem solver and he's one of the best diplomats that we have.
Hill will be the chief State Department representative in Iraq, just as the Obama administration reduces American military presence there. President Obama travels to Iowa today to discuss his energy plan, which includes provisions to end dependence on foreign oil and create jobs. He and the Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack will visit a former Maytag plant that's now a center for wind energy production. Let's look at big stories making headlines this morning, Lynn.
Thank you, Femi.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org and by the Skoll Foundation, supporting social entrepreneurs around the world. Uncommon heroes dedicated to the common good. Learn more at skoll.org.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual Insurance, offering home insurance products to individuals and families who put a premium on doing the right thing. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everyone. Happy Earth Day. It is Earth Day, and we're asking the question, you know, what is it you're not going to give up? What is it that's still left on your list? A lot of us have changed our behaviors in the many, many years since Earth Day began. Maybe you still drive a car to work, but you could use a bike. Brian emails us and says, I won't give up plane travel, especially for vacation. What poison won't you give up, Lynn?
This.
What is it?
It's a little foil packet that my tea bag lives in. No, no, no. It's the foil
packet. Oh, the
packet.
Foil packet.
Because it keeps it so fresh.
Mm. Well, adding to the landfill, our very own Lynn Scherr here. Tell us your poison at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org. Now, in honor of our next guest, who I will introduce in a moment, I want everyone to get up, go over to your cupboard, all right? Look at the ingredients on the stuff that's in your cupboard. Just grab something, something you're curious about, and answer the question when you call 877-8-MY-TIC. I was shocked to discover that in blank, there was blank. Okay? Do you know much about the ingredients in the stuff that's in your cupboard? We're going to talk about the importance of that in just a moment. But here's the founder of Earth Day, Wisconsin Senator Gaylord Nelson, speaking way back in 1970.
The battle to restore the proper relationship between man and his environment, between man and other living creatures, will be a long, sustained political, moral, and financial battle that will extend over a long period of time, a commitment far beyond any commitment any society ever made before.
Well, Senator Gaylord Nelson was right about that. The battle and the commitment is still going on. Green is a brand now. It's not a fringe movement. But does that help us to understand how to change our behaviors? Daniel Goleman joins us. He's the best-selling author of Ecological Intelligence, How Knowing the Hidden Impacts of What We Buy Can Change Everything. Thanks for being with us.
Pleasure, John.
And, you know, it is the case that just being green doesn't necessarily tell you much about the products that you buy. And if we don't know what we're buying and what we're doing, we're not really necessarily contributing to the planet at all.
Well, that's the point. Being green was a good first step, but it's really a baby step. What's different this Earth Day is that we can change the focus from what we do. Do you take a bike? Do you drive a car? To the things we buy. Mm-hmm. Because actually most of the problems in the planet are driven by a huge industrial machine that's cranking out pollutants. It's putting chemicals into our rivers, into our bodies that create disease. It's doing many, many things. And you know who's driving it? Us. Mm. But until today, we have never had access to the information that would help us do anything sane about it. Now we can be very smart.
Beyond an ingredients list, how do you get the sort of provenance of all the things that you buy?
Well, there's a new discipline. It's an academic discipline called industrial ecology. It's a group of industrial engineers, chemists, physicists, and so on, who are getting very precise metrics about the entire life story of any product. So they can tell you from the point of extraction of materials, concoction, manufacture, taking it to the store, the transport, time in store, your use, disposal. They can give you metrics that are extraordinarily exact for how much at this point in this step you're putting pollutants into the environment. You're creating disabilities in people down the road. They have amazing metrics. And for example, if you make a glass bottle,
right,
there are 1,959 distinct steps that these folks analyze. Each one has a full spectrum of impacts. And now all that information is available to you and to me at the store as we're about to buy that stuff.
Yeah, but how much Zoloft do you have to take to deal with all the guilt that's accumulated if you know all this stuff?
No guilt, because for the first time you should actually feel good, because there's something called Good Guide, one word, Good Guide, which you can download in your iPhone. And when you go to the store, it gives you access to this database, but it sums it up for you. It'll take anything you're going to buy, compare it to everything else in its product category, rank it for you in terms of what's the best impact on the environment, what has the least carcinogens and poisons in it, and it'll make it very easy for you. And so all you need to do is access the information.
In your experience as a psychologist, right, does this end up changing people's behavior, this kind of thing, knowing this kind of information?
Information is ultimately empowering. And now that we can shop with all of this expertise at hand, you and me and everybody we know can start making individual decisions that will ripple into business and make business have a good case actually a business case for cleaning up the supply chain.
Isn't it a little too much information from time to time? I mean, you make it sound as if I can just dial up a product and it'll say, yes, no, get this one instead. That's not been my experience. I can't read all those labels. I don't know what
No, you don't have to. No. Lynn, this is the fabulous thing. They did it for us. They summarize it. If you look at a shampoo, there's 50 ingredients.
Yeah.
But Skin Deep, another database, matches each of those ingredients to findings in medical databases. Does this cause cancer in rats? Well, maybe you don't want a shampoo that has something that causes cancer in rats. It actually ranks the 1,000-plus shampoos in terms of which is the safest
for you. Okay, Daniel Goldman, though. But, I mean, all they have to do is like what happens on Google. They just pay to get at the top of the search, right?
Not the marketers
will get a hold of this and they get
the guy top. Who's doing this, fabulous guy, his name's Dara O'Rourke. He's the one who busted Nike on their factory 7 years ago. He spent 15 years in factories at the worst end of the supply chain trying to figure out how to help those people. And what he realized is that the biggest help could come from you and me, from the people whose purchases are driving their conditions.
And so the information he disclosed about Nike changed people's purchasing habits
and
changed the company.
It changed Nike's philosophy. In fact, they're now the leaders in not having sweatshops. So in other words, the great news for Earth Day today is that there's a simple way for you and me every time we go to the store to vote with our dollars for a better world.
Daniel Goldman, best-selling author of Ecological Intelligence, How Knowing the Hidden Impacts of What We Buy Can Change Everything. You can see that interview on our website, thetakeaway.org, later on today, and I'll have a web-only question for Daniel Goldman. Thanks so much. And now, Femi Oke with the headlines.
Thank you. 21 minutes to the top of the hour. Federal prosecutors say the Somali pirate Abdi Wali Muse was the first to board the American cargo ship, the Alabama Maersk, and that he fired an AK-47 at the captain. Muse appeared in federal court in New York yesterday. Deirdre Van Dornham, his defense attorney, says the full story of the pirate attack on the Maersk, Alabama, has yet to be learned.
The charges are only the government side of it. We believe that Mr. Muse may be exonerated. So please be clear that what they put in their document is just their side of it.
Now, there has been some debate about how old Muse is. The prosecutors say that he is 18. Defense lawyers argue he's 15. And the judge ruled that he'll be tried as an adult. Today, the House is likely to pass a bill that would approve funding for 50,000 new neighborhood police officers over the next 5 years. The economic stimulus package provided $1 billion to expand the Community-Orientated Policing Services Grant Program, known as COPS. Phew, it was created under the Clinton administration. And finally, some news of a company doing well out of our economic downturn. It looks as if the recession in more people are actually heading for McDonald's. The restaurant reported today that its first quarter profit climbed almost 4%. So that's a look at stories making news for you this morning.
Supersize me. Thanks, Femi.
You're welcome.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Lynn Scherr.
And I'm John Hockenberry. And, you know, as far as big numbers are concerned, I think we've all been a little recalibrated. I mean, when somebody who's supposed to have a good idea of numbers, the Secretary of the Treasury, the guy behind the cash register of the United States government, says that all we have left in the TARP, the bank bailout fund, is $109 billion, I have to say my reaction is a little skewed.
$109 billion, that's it? I mean, what can you buy with a paltry $109 billion?
We hold the world ransom for $100 billion.
Remember, the Treasury Department started out with $700 billion. Now, that's some real money. And what did we buy with the $600 billion they've already spent? The solvency of the financial system, some AIG bonuses, and some other stuff. Where did the money go? Well, with this last pitiful $109 billion, let's not just fritter it away, okay? I mean, what can we buy with, and let's call it an even $110 billion?
T-minus 17 seconds and counting. 15.
How about
12,
58 11, space shuttles? 10, that's the cost of the last 9, shuttle built, the Endeavor, $1.7 billion. Or how about some real estate? Did you know we can get an Ecuador? or two Tanzanias, or three Ghanas. Or we could just blow all the $110 billion on ending world hunger three times over. Imagine how impressed people would be at parties if you could say, I just went crazy and ended world hunger. Or be smart. Pay down some debt. $110 billion? That's worth 26 days of the U.S. national debt. Or how about one-ninth of the total credit card debt in the U.S., which is $880 billion? Back in 1968, it was only $8 billion. We could buy 60% of annual U.S. war spending, which is $170 billion. Maybe not. Or we could just be silly, whimsical. How about 500 million iPhones? Or fiber optic broadband for the entire country, which means we could all video chat all the time. $110 billion buys you more than 10 annual Hollywood box office grosses. Imagine all the movies in one big blowout $110 billion weekend.
It's simple. Kill the Batman.
Once again, a UFO has landed in America. The only country UFOs ever seem to land in.
I think I figured it out.
He is not interested.
God help us all.
Yeah, God help us all. All the movies, one weekend, $110 billion. Okay, let's really just go crazy. Jay Leno, I've heard, had something like 50 cars and motorcycles in his collection in some garage somewhere. How about we just buy a whole bunch of Hummers?
I believe the Hummer is the best vehicle on the road. Big, tough, aggressive, and it represents everything that we want at Ole Miss. I have my Hummer. You need a Hummer.
Hummer, Hummer, Hummer. You know, we could buy 1.7 billion Hummers at 60 grand each for a new H3. Last year, GM only sold 20,000, so you could save General Motors and give a Hummer to every man, woman, and child in China for $110 billion. Act now. There's only $110 billion left in the TARP, and at these prices, it won't last long, Lynn.
John, there's a call for you on the other line.
Really?
Yeah, Secretary Geithner, he's got a few problems with your math.
Oh, great. I'll take the call. Tim? Tim, can I call you Tim?
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, soliciting opinions about schools that offer students cash rewards for improved grades and attendance records. Is it ethical? Is it bribery? Viewpoints now at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. In honor of Earth Day, go over to your cupboard, take out an item, look at the ingredients, and fill in the blanks. I was shocked to find blank in my blank. And on Earth Day, what's the one poison you still won't give up?
I'm Brianna, and I do not give up red meat. I love my red meat, even though I know it's terrible for the environment. But I'm only eating organic red meat, so I'm on my way to doing the right thing.
Call us on your way to doing the right thing. Do the right thing and call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org. Femi Okeh has the headlines.
Thank you very much. The time is just coming up to 12 minutes to the top of the hour. The acting chief financial officer at Freddie Mac has been found dead at his Virginia home this morning. Police say that it appears to be a suicide. David Kellerman was named acting CFO in September. He had worked with Freddie Mac for more than 16 years. The president's nominee for health secretary won the endorsement of the Senate Finance Committee. Kansas Governor Kathleen Sebelius still faces a full Senate vote before she can be confirmed. There's some GOP resistance to her over her support of a new government insurance plan. Confirmation hearings are being held today for the nominees to lead FEMA and Immigration and Customs Enforcement. Wells Fargo reports a record first quarter profit this morning, in line with forecasts. The bank says that it earned more than $2 billion last quarter, and Wells Fargo bought Wachovia last fall at the height of the credit crisis. And in international news, the polls are open in South Africa. It's a rainy election day there. This is the fourth election since the apartheid era ended 15 years ago. Former President Thabo Mbeki has already voted.
So we've got to vote for the kind of South Africa we fought for, a democratic South Africa, a prosperous South Africa, a united South Africa. and then choose whichever party we think would represent those values.
The governing African National Congress is expected to win seats in Parliament. And that's a look at your news for now.
Thank you, Femi. So some people cautiously say never, but not Barack Obama.
The United States is not and will never be at war with Islam.
That's the president speaking in Turkey earlier this month. Globalization means the world can feel smaller even as populations increase. But ideologies and principles of religion as a motive for war and terrorism, they don't necessarily shrink. And at the beginning of this century, they even seem to be expanding. Joining us is Reza Aslan. He's the author of How to Win a Cosmic War, God, Globalization, and the End of the War on Terror. How's that for a book title? He's here in the studio with us. Reza Aslan, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Now, at the beginning of the 20th century, there were a lot of people who wrote that the globally interlocked economy, and it was fairly globally interlocked back then, meant that there could not possibly be a world war. And then in 1914, boom, Europe stumbled into the most devastating conflict up to that time, and we've had a couple since. Why is globalization, and is globalization, any sort of insurance policy against a global, as you say, cosmic war over religion or ideology in this century?
Well, it may sound ironic, but in a way, you know, the great world wars of the 20th century had partly to do as sort of the inevitable consequences of nationalism. And in a sense, what globalization is doing as it's kind of fading away the borders and boundaries that used to sort of keep us as these kind of homogenous, sovereign nation states is that nationalism is no longer the primary marker of identity in large parts of the world, even in some sense here in the United States, where we still have a very strong sense of national identity. And I think as that starts to slip away, as people no longer begin to define themselves primarily in terms of their national identity, they're going to start going back to sort of more primal forms of identity like ethnicity and like religion, but especially religion, because in a sense, religion has always been that sort of initial, you know, force of globalization.
So that sounds like backsliding. That doesn't sound like moving forward towards an era of world harmony.
It depends. If you think of, you know, the end of the 19th and 20th century and the rise of secular nationalism as sort of showing, you know, the progress of humanity, then yes, it does seem like backsliding. But in a sense, some people would argue that part of the reason why people are becoming more religious or identifying themselves more, you know, in terms of religion is that in a way, secular nationalism kind of failed in the promises that it made. These, as you mentioned, these promises of global peace and security. The truth of the matter is the last century has been by far the bloodiest, most bestial century in human history.
Let me focus on what you talk about in your book. And I think there's a temptation sometimes to organize things democratically in the sense that if 51% of the people sign on to something, therefore it's going to move populations. And I'm wondering if there's an alternative view here. A lot of people may not act on the basis of their religion, but virtually anyone is capable of being insulted or offended based on somebody else's insult to their religion. So I'm wondering if a small group of individuals can actually motivate huge global changes to take place. It doesn't take a nation of suicide bombers to produce the war on terror. All it takes is 19 people in planes to produce the war on terror. So in that calculus, very few people can have enormous impacts. Don't you agree?
No question. But let's step back just for a moment here because, you know, in the United States, we have this tendency to think of religion as though it's some kind of personal, confessional experience. And the truth is that's not really how religion functions in most of the world, including here in the U.S. Religion for most people is a form of identity. It's about who we are as human beings. It's about our place and our sense of self in an indeterminate world. When almost 80% of Americans call themselves Christian, I mean, the truth is that 80% of Americans don't go to church every Sunday. 80% of Americans don't read, you know, the Bible. 80% of Americans probably can barely tell you who Jesus was.
Yeah, but six, you know, 19 guys show up and blow up a building in New York, and 80% of Americans believe they're involved in some sort of holy war.
Exactly. No, there's no question that extremism and radicalism is almost by definition always a minority movement, but it always is the loudest voice.
So you write How to Win a Cosmic War, but I'm wondering if a better question is, how do we avoid stumbling into a cosmic war
well,
in this century?
You just gave away the end of the book. Now you don't have to pay the $25 to No, the truth is, look, a cosmic war is a war in which participants believe that they are acting out on Earth a battle that's actually taking place in heaven between the forces of good and evil. And the argument of the book is that the Al-Qaeda and these like-minded, you know, militants that associate themselves with the jihadist movement are fighting a cosmic war, a war of their imagination, that their goals, their ideologies, their agendas are ridiculous, impossible to achieve in this life, which is, by the way, why they never talk about it. And unfortunately, what we have done by adopting the same religiously polarizing language, by adopting the same cosmic worldview, is that we are also fighting a cosmic war. And as you rightly say, there's no winning a cosmic war. You can't win something like
this. Well, on this getting the imagined cosmic warriors down to Earth, how do you rate the rhetoric of Barack Obama in the early going? Do you think it's a good approach?
I do think it's a very good approach. Look, if we are engaged in a war of ideology, as we've been constantly told that we are, then obviously our words can become our most important and most effective weapons. And I think what's great about Obama is that he understands this. He recognizes that words matter. Your rhetoric matters. And the fact that we have now, it seems, joined the rest of our European allies and given up this war on terror, rhetoric, which right. in and of itself is so deeply infused with this religious, cosmic, war sense, is a good start.
It's a great point. I mean, in a war of imagination and ideology, it's the words that really matter more than the weapons. Reza Aslan is the author of How to Win a Cosmic War, God, Globalization, and the End of the War on Terror. Thanks so much for being here.
So, we've got the environment on our mind because it's April 22nd, Earth Day, and we want to know, what's the one poison you still won't give up? We want you to do a little experiment for us. Go to your cupboard, take out an item, and fill in the blanks. I was surprised to find blank in my blank. Call us with your poisons and the ones you didn't know about in your cupboard at 877-78-MY-TAKE or MyTake at thetakeaway.org.
Well, I learned from author Daniel Goleman that you can use your iPhone at the grocery store to find out the environmental impact of what's on those shelves. But one of you had a good point.
I really like the idea that you can get the environmental impact quotient downloaded to your iPhone. Now here's a question. What's the environmental impact of the iPhone?
That's a good one. If you missed that interview with Daniel Goleman, take our podcast to go. Subscribe now at thetakeaway.org. or on iTunes. You also are going to want to listen back to our talk about credit and credit card debt with Anya Kamenetz, staff writer for Fast Company magazine and author of Generation Debt. And what was that, the fee harvesting cards?
Oh, yeah.
That was
the
scariest thing about that. Anyway, she has your takeaway.
The real problem with young people is that they get inculcated into this culture of debt. And given that you're already borrowing $20,000 to go to school, it seems normal to sign up for a campus credit card.
Normal. It's so easy. And even if you aren't a student in debt, she got you sharing your own stories.
This is Philomena from Westchester talking about credit card changes. I was talking to Bank of America yesterday because of a letter we received. We have over a 700 credit score, never paid the bill partially, always in full, and they decided to half our credit availability. They said they were too aggressive in the past, and it's an overall decision they've made. It's a little aggressive now to cut credit availability in half with a perfect score.
Ouch. Call us with your stories on any of this at 877-8-MY-TAKE. I'm John Hockenberry.
I'm Lynn Scher.
This is The Takeaway.
Hey, you got chocolate on my peanut butter.
You got peanut butter on my chocolate.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. The Rockefeller Foundation and its campaign for American workers. More at rockfound.org. And by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is The Takeaway.
Hair splitting on waterboarding.
With respect to those who formulated those legal decisions, I would say that is going to be more of a decision for the Attorney General within the parameters of various laws, and I don't want to prejudge that.
The torturous legal logic in the so-called torture memos may be grounds for prosecution, according to the president. Wiggle room on holding Bush administration officials accountable. Memo to Rumsfeld. See you in court. Could be on The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Memo to Rumsfeld. Good morning. It's Wednesday, April 22nd. I'm John Hockenberry, and Lynn Scherr is here for Adora Udoji. Good morning, Lynn.
Good morning, John. Ahead this hour, we will talk about the risks of prosecuting CIA lawyers and why no one investigated the history of the interrogation tactics that the CIA approved. We'll also look at the president's friendly approach to two troublesome neighbors, Venezuela and Cuba. Those stories coming up, but first, these headlines.
Voting is underway in South Africa in the fourth election since apartheid ended 15 years ago. 23 million people have registered to vote. The governing African National Congress is expected to win the parliament, but might lose its two-thirds majority. The CIA used harsh interrogation tactics systematically and with increasing reliance. That's according to a new report from the Senate Armed Services Committee. Yesterday, President Obama said it's up to the Justice Department to decide whether to prosecute the officials who crafted that policy. We'll have a lot more on that in just a few minutes. Lynn?
Lawyers for the sole surviving pirate from the cargo ship attack last week say he is just a frightened young man. Here's public defender Paul Weinstein.
I would say very scared, in pain, confused, concerned about not being able to practice his religion.
Prosecutors claim the pirate is 18 years old, but his defense lawyers argue that he is just 15. A crewman from the Maersk, Alabama, said the pirate was the first to board the ship firing an AK-47. Former Cuban leader Fidel Castro says President Obama misinterpreted his brother Raul when he said Cuba wants to be totally open in diplomatic talks with the U.S. Fidel Castro says the president had no right to suggest that Cuba make even small concessions. He responded through an essay on a government website.
Real shocker in Virginia this morning. The acting chief financial officer at Freddie Mac was found dead at his home. Police say it appears to be a suicide. David Kellerman was named acting CFO in September. He had worked with Freddie Mac for more than 16 years. Meanwhile, in just a few minutes, Treasury Secretary Geithner addresses the Economic Club of Washington. He defended the TARP bailout fund to the Congressional Oversight Panel yesterday. The Dow opens at 7970. The S&P starts trading today at 850. And it's Earth Day. So we're asking you, what's the one poison you still won't give up? You working down your list of behavior changes? We also want you to do a little experiment. Go to your cupboard, take out an item, fill in these blanks. I was surprised to find blank in my blank.
I'm checking the ingredients, and I noticed that there's glycerol ester of wood rosin in my soda. I don't know what glycerol ester of wood rosin is, but it's delicious.
Call us with your poisons. Look at that ingredients list and fill in the blanks for us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at KnightFoundation.org.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everyone. Just a few days ago, it was all about looking forward, not looking back. Listen to Rahm Emanuel, Barack Obama's chief of staff.
This is not a time for retribution. It's time for reflection. It is not a time to use our energy and our time in looking back and in a sense of anger and retribution. We have a lot to do to protect America. So what people need to know, this practice and technique, we don't use anymore. He banned it.
Then just yesterday, we learned that President Obama isn't ruling out the formation of a committee to investigate members of the Bush administration for their harsh interrogation methods used on detained terrorist suspects. Here is the president speaking yesterday in Washington.
For those who carried out some of these operations within the four corners of legal opinions or guidance that had been provided from the White House, I do not think it's appropriate for them to be prosecuted. With respect to those who formulated those legal decisions, I would say that that is going to be more of a decision for the Attorney General within the parameters of various laws, and I don't want to prejudge that.
So, Is this a flip-flop here by the Obama administration? Is that an invitation to the Department of Justice to begin prosecutions? Or more broadly, is it an invitation from the White House for Congress to get involved here? We're joined now by New York Congressman Jerry Nadler. He's the chair of the House Judiciary Subcommittee on the Constitution, Civil Rights, and Civil Liberties. Good morning, Congressman Nadler.
Good morning.
And you are my congressman. I should disclose that, being from Red Hook, Brooklyn. It's great to talk with you. And let's speak right off the top. Is this an invitation for you in Congress to begin bipartisan investigations into what the Bush administration did on interrogation tactics?
No, I don't think it's an invitation to Congress. I think, first of all, it's a recognition of the fact that these kinds of decisions, whether there should be an investigation, whether there should be into alleged breaking of the law, whether there should be prosecution, is properly the job of the Justice Department, which is supposed to be somewhat independent. In fact, in that kind of question, totally independent of anyone else. Remember, we carried on hearings in Congress and a lot of criticism of the Justice Department under President Bush because of its politicization, that it was responding to politics and making these kinds of judgments on political basis and listening to the White House. And the fact is that the Obama administration has pledged not to do that, and that these kinds of determinations should be made by the Attorney General and the people who work with him in the Justice Department, not by Congress and not, frankly, by the President or the White House.
The White House and the President yesterday seems to be separating the category of people at the CIA, who he said out at Langley he would not prosecute, who actually carried out the interrogation tactics, and the legal scholars and lawyers within the Justice Department and within the Bush administration who created the judicial rationale for those tactics. Those people might be subject to prosecution. Who would be on that list, Congressman Nadler?
Well, who would be on that list is up to the professional prosecutors at the Justice Department to take a look at, but certainly possibly Judge Bybee and John Yoo.
John Yoo? David Addington?
Conceivably, I don't know. I mean, you'd have to see what his responsibility was and what he really did. And again, it's up to the Justice Department to take these kinds of cases where the facts lead. And let me say one other thing. Even the people who actually did torture in the CIA, if they reasonably relied on instructions or legal guidance from the Justice Department, they should not be prosecuted. But if they didn't reasonably rely, and the difference is a distinction to be made by the Justice Department, then they also should be subject to investigation and prosecution. You're entitled to reasonably rely, but not unreasonably.
Well,
and that's the law.
You are a congressman, even though you're not a prosecutor. Do you believe these individuals should be prosecuted? And if so, what would the law be? What would the punishment be?
I believe that the Justice Department has to look at the facts and determine whether these people should be prosecuted. I don't think they should be immune, but I'm not going to say as a member of Congress who should and shouldn't be prosecuted. I believe that obviously torture was done. It was done very deliberately, and there ought to be prosecutions. Who should be prosecuted should be decided on a non-political basis by the Justice Department.
What's the mission of this process? Barack Obama and members of the administration were saying we need to look forward, not get into a retribution mentality, but is this about truth and reconciliation, a la, say, South Africa, where we all get to feel as though there's been accountability here? Or are you sending a specific message to a specific place in the bureaucracy, this will not be tolerated?
Well, I think it's both. I think both of those things are true, and I think it's a matter of justice, not retribution, and not looking forward or looking backward. I think, if talking about we looking forward, well, then you'd never prosecute any crime that's always in the past. All justice has to look backward as well as forward, and all history teaches us. All history teaches that if you don't hold people accountable, if you don't say that people committed crimes are going to be tried and punished, then other people are going to commit the same crimes again. And that's why simply shining a light on crimes is not sufficient. They must be prosecuted where the evidence is there. And frankly, beyond that, the United States has an obligation to investigate and, where warranted, prosecute torture. The Convention Against Torture, which is a treaty that was drafted partially by the United States, that was signed by the President and ratified by the Senate, which is the law of the land in the United States, says that where torture occurs on our territory or under our control, we must prosecute. It says we must investigate, and where there's evidence of torture, we must prosecute. So we have no choice unless we're going to disobey the law.
Congressman, following up on John's point about the truth and reconciliation idea, when that happened in Rwanda, in South Africa, the idea was so that the rest of the country wouldn't have to live through so much of that again afterwards. What effect do you think this will have on our country to be going through all these things again?
Well, it depends. To go through what? If it is a question of an investigation by a special counsel appointed for that purpose by the Justice Department, as I think it should be, and if that special counsel decides that some people are to be prosecuted, and they are, and some are presumably found guilty and perhaps others acquitted, I think it will have a very good effect on the country. It will cause people in government, whether in low positions or high positions in government in the future, to think twice before breaking the law.
Well, except it's also going to reinforce this idea, another administration, another special prosecutor, here we go again. Every time since Watergate, there's been a special prosecutor. Congress spends most of its time looking back. How do you combat that cynicism?
Well, I don't know what the cynicism is. As I said, if crimes are committed, they must be prosecuted, and that inherently looks back.
Okay.
And we have a law that says we must investigate, and where the facts warrant, prosecute. And that is cases of torture, and we must do that. That is our duty under the law. It's our duty to civilization. And if people are discomfited by it, they shouldn't see torture in the first place.
John asked you about some of the specifics about who might be singled out for prosecution or who might be on the list. How high do you think it could go, and could it get to the executive branch?
Well, it certainly could and should get to the executive branch. Whoever committed torture was in the executive branch, and whoever ordered torture was in the executive branch.
All right, well, let's get specific then, Congressman. Vice President Cheney is on Fox News, it seems, every day, talking about how critical he is of the Barack Obama administration. Are you anxious to get him under subpoena, under oath, to talk about those memos?
The answer is that it's not a question of whether I'm anxious to get the former vice president.
No, that is the question.
The question is, when the Justice Department looks, they ought to go where the facts lead them. If the facts lead them to Vice President Cheney, then he ought to be under oath and perhaps prosecuted.
No, but you can call a hearing. You could subpoena him tomorrow. You could subpoena him tomorrow.
Well, I'm not the Justice Department. I'm not going to subpoena him.
No, but Congress can subpoena the vice president.
Oh, for an investigation?
Sure.
Yeah, and maybe we should. But I think, first of all, when you're talking about this, I'd rather see a special prosecutor, a special counsel, put in and see where the facts take it. Congress is not a substitute for investigation and prosecution of crimes.
What about Secretary Rumsfeld?
Again, depending where the facts take him, quite conceivably.
And you could subpoena him tomorrow. Do you have a position on Secretary Rumsfeld coming before your committee or a committee of Congress?
I am not going to get into now who we should subpoena. I think that the proper process first is that a special counsel ought to be appointed in the Justice Department and ought to investigate as any counsel would investigate and prosecute the crimes, and the people who ought to be subpoenaed and the people who ought to be prosecuted depend on where the facts take them. The role of Congress is somewhat different. Our role should be to investigate with a view toward changing laws. And who are the specific people is a very different question.
Well, Congressman, thanks so much for joining us. That's well said, and we covered a lot of ground there. New York Congressman Gerald Nadler, Democrat, chair of the House Judiciary Subcommittee on the Constitution, Civil Rights, and Civil Liberties. Thanks so much.
You're quite welcome.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, asking what is responsibility in this day and age. Everybody has their own opinion. Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. If you were with us just a few moments ago, Congressman Gerald Nadler, Democrat, speaking about interrogation techniques, the so-called torture memos, following the facts where they lead, who authorized those interrogation tactics, and were any laws broken? Well, the facts lead this morning to the front page of our partners, the New York Times, which takes a look at the genesis of the program which led to the interrogation tactics that have been outlined in the memos that have been released last week, and more revelations are coming out every day. Scott Shane joins us, reporter for our partner, the New York Times, from Washington. Scott, first of all, what is the genesis, as we understand it now, of these interrogation techniques? Where did they find the techniques, and what can we begin to learn about the process of authorizing them at the highest levels of the Bush administration?
Well, the White House, President Bush, decided that the CIA should be the agency charged with detaining and questioning the high-level al-Qaeda operatives that they hoped to catch after the 9/11 attacks. But the CIA had very little experience, almost no experience, interrogating hostile people. They had some folks who were used to questioning, of course, agents and trying to figure out who was a double agent and that sort of thing. But they didn't have a traditional kind of interrogation experience of the kind that was more common in the FBI and the military. So first the CIA consulted various other countries, and then they turned to a military training program called SERE, S-E-R-E, for survival survival, evasion, resistance, and escape. That was a program which, under various names, dated back to the 1950s, and it had been created after the Korean War because the Chinese had held a bunch of American pilots during the Korean War, and some of those pilots had given false confessions to germ warfare and various other things. And that led to concern about how Americans could withstand interrogation and to some suspicions that the communists had some kind of secret brainwashing techniques. So there were a lot of studies done of what exactly was done with these American prisoners. And as a result, they created this program, this training program, to give military personnel who were seen to be at high risk of capture a taste of what they might face if they were captured and interrogated.
So the original program was, this is what the Chinese communists do. How did it become, this is what the CIA does?
Well, what's interesting is that what our reporting suggested was that the history of that program was lost. When the CIA went to look at these methods, at least top officials had no idea that these were methods that had been used by our communist Cold War enemies, and that in the 50s and 60s had been identified as torture, and specifically as torture that had the result of producing false confessions.
You're saying they just basically
took the origin of the program.
They just took it off the shelf and just started reading.
They just took it off the shelf, and what they said was, they were looking for a way, you know, in that atmosphere of to take the gloves off, as the saying was back then, to get tough on these terrorists, because they had the theory that these terrorists would not respond to the kind of ordinary interrogation that the United States had traditionally used. But, of course, the problem with taking the gloves off is that you run up against laws against torture.
Right. Well,
they thought this would get them off the hook.
Well, let's talk about that. And, again, there's a lot of ground to cover here, so I want to keep moving along here. The authorization, how high does it go? And when the CIA asked what laws apply here and how can we do this legally, who is involved in those decisions?
Well, a wide array of top officials, President Bush, Vice President, President Cheney, cabinet officials like Colin Powell, who was then Secretary of State, and Don Rumsfeld, the Secretary of Defense, Condoleezza Rice, who was the National Security Advisor,
wow,
and others all were briefed on these methods by George Tenet, the CIA director, and four members of Congress, the top officials of the intelligence committees in the House and Senate, were also briefed, and no one objected, no one dissented.
Now, let's talk a little bit about the revelations as we understand them over the past few weeks. This story began with revelations from whistleblowers within the administration who wanted this information out. As you've reported this story, was it widely thought that this was an appropriate program, or was it widely believed that the CIA had gone off the rails here, as you talk to people in the bureaucracy?
I think attitudes changed over time. As I said, there were no dissents when the program was first presented and approved. And that includes people like Colin Powell, who, of course, had vast military experience and who subsequently was extremely upset at the use of these techniques. But part of the problem was the CIA briefings completely omitted the history, for example, of waterboarding, the fact that it had been used by virtually every despotic regime since the Spanish Inquisition, and presented it as sort of a clinical, quick way to scare someone into talking. And I think as the history began to be better known, there was more dissent even at the upper ranks of the Bush administration. And by 2004 and 2005, there were voices internally that were pushing back. Another thing that happened was the CIA Inspector General completed a secret report on the program in 2004, which was highly critical and raised questions about its legality.
Well, thank you, Scott. All the details on the front page of the New York Times this morning. Scott Shane and Mark Mazzetti jointly wrote the piece. Scott Shane, a reporter for the New York Times, joining us from Washington, D.C. And now Femi Okeh has some headlines.
At 28 minutes past the hour, there are some good earnings reports in this morning from Wells Fargo and McDonald's. They reported profits last quarter, but bad news from Boeing, AT&T and Morgan Stanley. They all posted losses. The Senate has confirmed President Obama's choice to be the next U.S. ambassador to Iraq. Chris Hill will take the position over the strenuous objections of Republican Senator Sam Brownback, who filibustered the appointment. The senator accused Hill of ignoring human rights abuses while he was the Bush administration's chief negotiator with North Korea. Former Cuban leader Fidel Castro says that President Obama misinterpreted his brother Raúl when he said Cuba wants to be totally open in diplomatic talks with the U.S. Castro responded via an essay on a government website saying that not all matters will be up for discussion. And some good news for neighborhood police officers. The House is likely to pass a bill today that would approve funding for 50,000 new neighborhood police officers over the next 5 years. The economic stimulus package provides $1 billion to expand the community-orientated police services grant program, coincidentally known as COPS. That's all of your news for now.
Thank you, Femi.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org, and by the Skoll Foundation, supporting social entrepreneurs around the world. Uncommon heroes dedicated to the common good. Learn more at skoll.org.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual Insurance, offering home insurance products to individuals and families who put a premium on doing the right thing. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
I'm Lynn Sharon for Adora Udoji, and today is Earth Day. What is the one poison you still won't give up?
The thing that I can't seem to get away from, which is kind of ridiculous, is the bottled water. I know it's insane, but I just can't seem to do it.
Yeah, it is insane. You could just get your own bottle and just carry it around with you. Anyway, we want you to do a little experiment for us. Go to your cupboard, take out an item, and fill in the blanks. Here's the sentence. I was surprised to find blank in my blank. Call us up with your poisons and the ones you didn't know about at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org.
Some surprises there in the ingredients, and we're hearing about a lot of them from all of you. So when the Summit of Americas happened over the weekend, it was kind of a surprise to see Barack Obama chumming it up there with Hugo Chavez of Venezuela. And the president explained it this way. No harm done.
Venezuela is a country whose defense budget
is probably 1/600th of the United States. They own Citgo. It's unlikely that, as a consequence of me shaking hands or having a polite conversation with Mr. Chavez, that we are endangering the strategic interests of the United States. I don't think anybody can find any evidence that that would do so.
Well, some folks are looking. Today, Secretary of State Hillary Clinton goes before the House International Relations Committee, where Republican Mike Pence is promising to grill the Secretary of State over what he calls deeply offensive images of the president shaking hands with Hugo Chavez. Former ambassador to Venezuela for President Ronald Reagan and a former senior special envoy and diplomat in the administrations of Ronald Reagan and George H.W. Bush and George W. Bush joins us now, Ambassador Otto Reich from Miami. Thanks for joining us, Ambassador.
Thank you.
Do you find the images of Barack Obama, you know, sort of chumming it up there in a couple of moments during the Summit of the Americas offensive?
Well, they send the wrong signals. And I think that, you know, for such a smart person, I think President Obama just made some comments that indicate he doesn't quite understand the importance of symbolism in international relations. The chumminess, to continue using the term, sent a signal that was very confusing to our friends and our adversaries in Latin America. In Latin America, Hugo Chavez is the least popular leader, according to a hemispheric-wide poll that was released before the summit, because people know that he's undermining democracy in Venezuela, that he's has supported the terrorists next door in Colombia, and that he has tried to rally the hemisphere against the United States. For the president to go down and pretend that those things have never happened is quite confusing to those leaders who have tried to be friends of the United States, to say the least.
But what do you say to the argument that by setting Hugo Chavez up and the Castros also by implication in Cuba as something of a great Satan here in the Western Hemisphere, that in fact we elevate them, we inflate their status rather than diminish them?
Well, I don't think anybody is setting them up as any great Satan. That would be equally incorrect. That would be also not understanding the importance of symbolism. In fact, it's interesting that it was Hugo Chavez who called George W. Bush the great devil, the devil, in his now famous speech at the United Nations. So we don't have to demonize people to recognize the fact that the Castros have executed over 7,000 Cubans. They've exiled 15% of the population. They have promoted revolution, violent revolution, all over this hemisphere. To take them seriously.
Taken seriously is one thing, but do you support regime change in Cuba and Venezuela?
I support democracy. I don't believe that democracy and freedom should be the sole province of northern white blue-eyed educated people. I think that freedom should be is in fact the best system of government for everybody. I think it's incorrect to think that people in Cuba have chosen to live under a dictatorship. They've never had a free. They haven't had a free election since long before Batista.
So you don't support regime change in Venezuela?
I support democracy and freedom in Venezuela. I think Chavez has undermined democracy. He has censored the press. He has eliminated many freedoms in Venezuela. He just exiled yesterday, for example. Every day there's something. Yesterday, the mayor of the second largest city in Venezuela, Maracaibo, had to get on an airplane and flee the country. This is the freely elected mayor of the second largest city, and fly to Peru to seek political asylum because Chavez was threatened to throw him in jail. You know, this is not the kind of government that we should have. The president of the United States shaking hands and slapping on the back and smiling. You know, the president has to be diplomatic. He
right.
has to be cordial, but he doesn't have to slap people on the back who are literally extinguishing the flames of freedom in their own country.
Finally, Ambassador, what would you say is the constructive consequence of the policy of disengagement with the Castros in Cuba during your tenure in government?
I don't know what you mean by disengagement. Because
what has it accomplished? What has the embargo and the not dealing with the Castros directly accomplished since Ronald Reagan?
Well, first of all, we have diplomatic relations with Cuba, so we do deal with the Castros directly. We have an intersection, a diplomatic intersection in Havana. The Cubans have an intersection in Washington, so we do have diplomatic relations. What we don't have is we don't have ambassadors, but we conduct diplomatic relations. The embargo is a unilateral action by the United States. The United States is the single largest provider of food to Cuba. I mean, a lot of people don't realize this. They think that we have blockaded the Cuban ports or something like that. In fact, that is the language that the Cuban government uses, the blockade. They don't even call it the embargo. The United States shipped $700 million worth of food last year, which is more than the next several countries combined to Cuba. We are not the reason why the Cuban people are poor and hungry. The reason they're poor and hungry is the communist government of Cuba, which has not changed its philosophy or its policies in 50 years.
Well, we'll leave it there. Ambassador Otto Reich is the former U.S. ambassador to Venezuela. And now Femi Oke has some quick headlines.
Thank you very much, John. Now, the ambassador was talking about the Obama's forays into the Americas. Hillary Clinton is expected to field questions on the president's trip before the House Foreign Affairs Committee today. She will defend the president's foreign policy, including the handshake that took place last week between President Obama and Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez. Treasury Secretary Tim Geithner says that the U.S. bears a substantial share of responsibility for the global economic crisis, but the problems that have made the crisis so dire are worldwide. And the world economy is likely to shrink this year for the first time in six decades. The news comes from the IMF. It projects a 1.3% drop in a new forecast out today.
Thank you, Femi.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry.
And I'm Lynn Scherer. We've been talking about the elections taking place in South Africa today. It is the most significant election since the end of apartheid. There are 23 million registered voters and an expected, listen to this, 80% turnout. We're going to go now to Port Elizabeth on South Africa's south coast to talk to two of the voters. First of all, good morning, Ati Singapi. You are 24 years old, I understand. And you're one of the born frees, a voter who came of age after apartheid. This is a great day for you, right?
Certainly is. Thank you very much.
Have you voted yet, Ati?
Not yet. I'm still on my way to go and cast my vote.
And as I understand...
I've gone up until 9 o'clock.
Okay. As I understand it, you own a travel business. Is that correct?
Correct.
Okay. Who are you going to vote for? Will you tell us?
Certainly, no shame in that. I'm definitely going for the breakaway group, the group that broke away from the ANC, and that is the COPE Party.
And why are you voting for COPE and not for the ANC?
The ANC has been full of promises which they haven't lived up to. I'm voting for COPE as they represent the new hope and the new change that this country needs very much at this point in time.
Ati, stay on the line for a minute. I want to also go to Tandukolo Bomali, another voter speaking to us from Port Elizabeth. Mr. Bomali, are you there?
Yes, ma'am, I'm here.
Okay, and who are you going to vote for today?
Lucky, I've already voted. So I don't have a problem. I don't have a problem telling you that I voted for the ANC.
So you voted for the ANC, which means that Jacob Zuma will be your candidate.
Because Jacob Zuma.
And why did you vote for the ANC?
Yeah. You know, the ANC has been there for us. Yeah, I know we have challenges along our way. But with the policies that they have, especially for our people, they are catering mostly for the blacks. But in the long run, I know that it's going to cater for everyone. You see? So ANC is the best party for us.
Okay, but you say they've taken care of you. You are, as I understand it, unemployed. There's a huge unemployment rate in South Africa. Do you think Mr. Zuma is going to fix that?
Yeah. I think there's going to be a change. Yeah, just to take you back, you know, Moses, been from the apartheid era. We are still new on the democracy. So it's still a learning area for us. But I think things are going to change for now. Because at least we've got 15 years of democracy.
Okay, Mr. Bomali, thank you. Ati Singapi, let me talk to you very briefly. You don't trust Jacob Zuma, is that right?
I don't trust him one bit. He's full of promises. He has not lived up to his promises. They've put good policies in place, but those policies are all fancy and rosy in paper, but they fail to implement. ANC people always kind of uplift each other. There's no fairness. There's no democracy in that party. It's all about themselves and who they favor.
Wow. And this, ladies and gentlemen, is what elections are
yes,
all about.
Yes, indeed. Right, I feel like I'm there, right on the streets of Port Elizabeth.
These two nice people. Thank you both for joining us, Ati Singapi and Tandukolo Bomali from Port Elizabeth, South Africa. And the polls are still open, so if you're listening to us in South Africa, go and vote.
ANC versus COPE and, I guess, 199 other parties.
23 million voters. It's going to be quite a day.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, soliciting opinions about schools that offer students cash rewards for improved grades and attendance records. Is it ethical? Is it bribery? Viewpoints now at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
It's not that easy being green.
Yeah, Kermit's got a point there. On Earth Day, even. So what's the one poison you still won't give up?
Whatever we do, we can't give up bottled water. We're trying, but whenever we buy a non-disposable bottle, there's something wrong with the taste of the water or the bottle leaks, and we try to reuse the disposable bottles that we're buying and put them in recycling, but I know that's not the answer.
Well, keep trying. Here's another job for you. Go to your cupboard, look at the ingredients on a product you use, and fill in these blanks. I was surprised to find blank in my blank.
I was surprised to find high fructose corn syrup in my tomato soup. Happy Earth Day.
Norma in South Carolina. Blue dye number one, a potent allergen in my chocolate pudding.
Call us with the poisons you found in your cupboard, 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. Thanks, Kermit. Now, Femioke has some headlines.
12 minutes to the top of the hour. Good morning, everybody. The acting chief financial officer of Freddie Mac has been found dead in his Northern Virginia home. Police say that it appears David Kellerman committed suicide. The 41-year-old Kellerman took over as the mortgage giant's chief financial officer in September. In Washington, Treasury Secretary Tim Geithner says that the modern world has never been hit by such simultaneous economic and financial turmoil. He spoke to an economic council in Washington, and Geithner also laid out details from the recovery plan he'll start pushing in meetings on Friday. Staying in Washington, Secretary Clinton has just started speaking before Congress. She'll be talking about the president's fresh approach to world politics. She's getting a difficult time from Republicans. Let me quote you one congressman here. He says, this is the beginning of the quote, "Many Americans are working hard to make ends meet. We must be sure we can justify our contributions to foreign nations." End of quote. And finally, a quick look at some news from overseas for my news of the weird file, just blowing off the dust off the top of the file. So a Paris exhibition of preserved corpses has been ordered to close after a judge ruled it was an affront to the dignity of the human body. Now, the exhibition has been shown in the US and Germany, and it's called Our Body. It features 17 Chinese bodies, and two French human rights groups have called for the exhibition to be closed as they weren't actually convinced the bodies came from consenting individuals. Now, the court has demanded the seizure of the human remains, and the judge says in Paris that the proper place for corpses is the cemetery. I have actually seen that exhibition, and it's fascinating.
Well, not in Paris, apparently. Mm. Thank you, Femi.
Shame.
Okay, I don't know how to get from that to this, but
yeah,
I'm going to move
quite
on
a
anyway.
Segue, yeah.
It sounds like, this one sounds like something out of my junior high school history book. A pirate on trial for crimes on the high seas. But there's absolutely nothing romantic about what happened in federal court in New York City yesterday when Abdulwali Moussa walked dazed before a slew of photographers and did what anyone who may have never before seen a camera might have done. He smiled. He is the only Somali pirate, as you all no doubt know, captured in the hijacking of the cargo ship Maersk Alabama, and he was charged with five counts yesterday, including the crime of piracy. So who is he and how old is he? Well, joining us now is Neil Quartaro, a lawyer with Watson, Farley & Williams and an adjunct associate professor at Columbia School of International and Public Affairs. Welcome.
Thank you. Good morning.
Nice to have you here. Let's start with the age issue. Why do we care how old this clearly young under any circumstance fellow really is?
Well, hopefully, for the prosecutors, he's of the age of majority. If he's not, there are...
Which is 18.
Which would be 18. If he's not, there would be a very real question as to whether or not he could form the underlying intent to commit some of the crimes that he's been accused of. Because Somalia is, of course, a failed state, this isn't a question that may be easily answered. Apparently, his father has come out and claimed that he's born in 1993. The U.S. Attorney's Office has indicated that he may have made statements that, in fact, he's older than that. So that's going to be probably a key issue, and it may be something that's difficult, in fact, to prove.
Well, the judge has now ruled that, in fact, he is 18 and he can stand trial in this courtroom. Is that correct?
Yes, I believe the magistrate judge yesterday made that
So
made that
for the
ruling.
Moment, at least, that's done.
That's correct.
Okay, let's move on to what I just can't wrap my mind around. This is a pirate case. Does anybody really know how to deal with this?
I would say not anymore. It's been a long time since there was a pirate prosecution here in the United States.
How long?
Really, we go back to the 1860s. There are a couple of small cases that involve interesting fact patterns, revolutions and rebellions in Latin America, for example, where there's blockades imposed and there are issues raised there that are sort of similar to piracy and actually similar to the situation that we have here. Because these are these would be insurgencies that have not been recognized. So we have sort of lawless state actors, so somewhat comparable. But the real piracy trials really go back to the 1860s, and the majority of those, in fact, are slavery-related, not the sort of depredation on the high seas that we typically think of when we think of pirates.
I think of the Barbary pirates. You'll forgive me. It's my only education in piracy, except for... Halloween, when and you know movies, but it was a romantic sense of things then that the world was wide open, people could do what they wanted. It was scary, and now of course we're in a very different world, and it's terrorism. So first of all, laws were written. I mean, it was Thomas Jefferson's law, right? I mean, doesn't it go back that far?
Yeah, it goes back, I would say, even further than that. Piracy was a crime that was tried here in the United States prior to independence by the British Vice Admiralty Courts, and that's something that was carried on by U.S. Admiralty Courts post-independence.
And it was a capital crime then?
That's correct, yes. In fact, the statute that makes piracy a crime initially is there's a series of them, but there's one in 1820, the Act of 1820, that specifically criminalizes it and terms the slave trade as piracy as well.
But this is one of those things where maybe the history assists the prosecutors in this particular case. I mean, why is it any different? I mean, it's really no different.
No, I
agree. If it's a capital crime then, it should be a capital crime now. What's the difference?
The only difference is there's been a slight statutory change where the mandatory penalty is no longer death, it's life imprisonment.
And does the fact that Somalia is a lawless state, as you point out, Does that change anything in terms of what the defense for this fellow ought to be?
Yes, absolutely. The Barbary Pirate case, or cases, there was a series of incidents. One of the things that's interesting about that is that at a certain level, the United States recognized that the pirates sailing from the Barbary Coast were, in fact, armed and flying the flag of the local political entity. And there was even some talk of either the local caliph dead or the American prisoner returned. And the upshot of that is that we recognize those pirates, so to speak, as belligerents and as emissaries, not emissaries, but as agents of a foreign state. That would allow us to do things like treat them as prisoners of war.
Right.
In this particular case, of course, we don't have that. We have literally pirates who are sailing out without any lawful claim of authority and without flying a flag. That's, you know, quite literally the Jolly Roger instead of the flag, a flag belonging to a nation state. And it should be noted that most, if not all, ships are citizens of the state whose flag they fly. By its very act, flying the Jolly Roger or not flying a flag places a ship beyond sovereignty. And that's sort of the international definition.
So how does that change a trial or a punishment?
Well, if we have a belligerent state that we're dealing with, we're going to have one set of rules, and that's going to implicate sort of prisoner of war type doctrines. If we have a non-recognized belligerent, a lawless state actor like a pirate, or one might say a terrorist, at that point, the domestic law of the United States is going to apply, assuming that we can get jurisdiction over this person, and we certainly have jurisdiction over Mr. Moosey.
Neil Cortoro, a lawyer with Watson, Farley & Williams, and an adjunct associate professor at Columbia School of International and Public Affairs. Come back when the trial is on, please.
So, on Earth Day, it's hard to give things up, and someone emailed on our website, thetakeaway.org, what will I not give up? It's not a question of compliance, it's a question of limited choices. Why do I have to drive when I would prefer public transportation? Why am I forced to burn oil when my town won't build wind generators? Because being environmental means knowing where and how your products are made, go to your cupboard, look at an ingredients list on some product, and fill in the blanks for this, won't you? I was surprised to find blank in my blank. Tell us the poisons you found, the ones you were surprised about, and what you can't give up, all here for Earth Day at thetakeaway.org. And your takeaway comes from Washington.
If you don't say that people committed crimes are going to be tried and punished, then other people are going to commit the same crimes again. And that's why simply shining a light on crimes is not sufficient. They must be prosecuted where the evidence is there.
Where do the facts lead? New York Congressman Gerald Nadler wants to know, talking about President Obama and prosecuting people from the previous administration on the torture memos. I'm John Hockenberry. You are...
Lynn, sure. Lovely to be with
Earth Day. Lovely to be with you, Lynn. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. The Rockefeller Foundation and its campaign for American workers. More at rockfound.org. And by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is The Takeaway.
At Radiolab, we love nothing more than nerding out about science, neuroscience, chemistry.
But we do also like to get into other kinds of stories. Stories about policing. Or
politics.
Country music.
Hockey.
Sex. Of bugs.
Regardless of whether we're looking at science or not science, we bring a rigorous curiosity to get you the answers.
And hopefully make you see the world anew.
Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know.
Wherever you get your podcasts.